Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to another level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm also a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and you may or you may not agree with things that are said. Once again, I'd ask you to keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight, my guest is David P. Ingerson. He's an exciting communicator who has spoken to audiences around the world. During his 20 years as a U.S. Air Force officer and pilot, he traveled extensively and lived abroad with his family. From the time he was ordained as a teacher and evangelist while serving in Okinawa, Japan, he has trained and led teams on short-term missions to the Philippines and Cambodia, declaring the good news with compelling, inspirational stories. As a corporate pilot, he has traveled to nearly every country on five continents and takes with him great respect and appreciation for the myriad of cultures. Having suffered his own share of trials and setbacks as an entrepreneur, he encourages both employees and customers to rise above life's difficulties and griefs. Given his track record of overcoming challenges, David has credibility when he exhorts others that the path to success is found and walked with intentionality and hard work rather than glamour and ease. He is genuine and passionate as he encourages his listeners to honestly admit their life's challenges and disappointments. Through his personal inspirational story of triumph through tragedy, he spurs others to rise above life's frustrations and overcome in spite of intimidating obstacles, even as dreadful as facing congenital heart defects and HIV and grieving the death of a child. David and his wife, Kathleen, are the parents of five children, and they make their home in Shreveport, Louisiana. And with that said, I'd like to welcome David. David, once again, how are you tonight?
Thank you very much. Absolutely fine, David. It's a pleasure for me to be with you tonight.
Well, I'm really glad to have you here and that you were able to fill in this spot tonight on such short notice. So thank you for that, too. And I'm very interested in kind of getting into your story as an up-and-coming evangelist. Can you tell me a little bit about your journey through faith or religion from the time that you were growing up through your early adult years?
David, I certainly will. In fact, I very much appreciate that invitation to so do. Interestingly enough, my brother and I were born to a mother with our father when she was still in college, and he was as well. And she, my mother, our mother, was widowed when my brother was 2.5 years old and I was 1 year old. And she was a junior in college. She was pursuing an education degree, which she finished only one semester late. Her stories talk about how she had a hard time sleeping, falling asleep in class, taking care of two small children, studying at night. From her difficult years, she learned that there's no tomorrow, and she often would say that to me growing up, that there's no tomorrow. Well, when it came to the family, just 1 year and 1 month, 13 months after the death of my father when I was 11 months old, and by the way, he died in a car accident. He fell asleep at the wheel after working two jobs back-to-back. I was in 11 months old. I was in the car. Apparently, as the story goes, I was bounced out of the car before the roof of the car was leveled down to the doors. And he died of massive head injuries, closed casket scenario, and I lived. I got a few bumps and bruises, and I think a bump on the head, which explains a few things. At any rate. So growing up, my mother, 13 months later, married a gentleman that didn't adopt us legally, and in some ways emotionally, he struggled, I think, to adopt us, so to speak. And so with a different last name than our mother and our father growing up, we felt sort of sometimes alone, I think, and I did in particular. No kidding, as a kindergarten young child, I remember riding my bicycle down the street, somewhat rural area in Michigan, and looking up and actually asking, God, who are you? God, where are you? I don't know how many kindergartners ask that, but and then through high school, through elementary school and junior high school, there was some spiritual dabblings, but I don't think I really connected and understood much about God until I went off to the United States Air Force Academy as a young high school graduate. And just the traditional chapel, the chapel experience, I just sort of joined into it almost by default, not that I really thought this is the way or something like that. But in January of my freshman year at U.S. Air Force Academy, a chaplain named Charlie Baldwin, who's retired two-star general now, Chaplain Baldwin brought light into darkness, meaning these were very difficult days for cadets at the Air Force Academy in January. The days are short. The sun sets over the mountains early, about 4:30 p.m. It's cold, and they're called the Dark Ages. It's sort of a joke, so to speak, but they're called the Dark Ages. You're back from Christmas break where you had a nice time with family, and you're depressed, so to speak. Well, into the Dark Ages, the cadet said, he brought what he called a weekend of light. The first speaker was astronaut Jim Irwin. Jim Irwin came to us. I don't know if he was 70 years old or what age he was at that time. That was 1983, and he's passed on now. Jim Irwin was famous for, as an astronaut, finding a white rock on the moon that had no dust on it, and it wasn't hot. The scientist, it's in the Smithsonian to this day, it shouldn't have been there, or it shouldn't have been not hot, apparently, should not have been cool. It baffled the scientist. When he saw that white rock as he walked on the moon, he was a fighter pilot, the right stuff, astronaut, lived the fast lane, wine, women, and song, didn't have much time for God. But when he saw that white rock, and this is the story he told us during that weekend of light when I was a young freshman at the Air Force Academy, he said he heard a voice that said just three words, Jim, it's time. He knew Jim, it's time meant it's time to give the Creator, to give God his attention, his allegiance, he'd ignored him for his life. I guess he was 40, 45 years old, whatever age he was at that time. And he became rather famous when he came back from the moon sharing his story. I think sometimes the media made more of it, astronaut finds God in outer space. You know, that is something which can be sort of sensationalized. But he even spoke in Moscow back during the days before the Cold War ended. When I heard him share his story that night, I was just so moved. And I was actually only there because I had to sing with the choir. I didn't really want to be there because I thought this real religious program doesn't sound exciting to me. Something drew me.
Everything happens for a reason, doesn't it?
How about that? You know, I always sing loudly. I enjoy singing. And we sang one of these traditional hymns. But I was all choked up. I couldn't even hardly sing or speak. And I was so glad when the fourth verse of that traditional hymn came because I knew we're done. Whew, thank you. I can leave. But the chaplain Charlie Baldwin, stood back up and said, there's one more person that needs to come forward. They had this, you know, it's called an altar call. You come to the altar and you say, yes, I recognize that Jesus is God, the Son of God, that he died for me to pay the penalty for my sin, to purchase for me a place in heaven that he offers as a free gift. Such a simple message, one that I suppose I was familiar with, but had never embraced on a personal level, maybe didn't even fully understand. So here we are. I was just choked up, and I didn't know why. I didn't want to be choked up. I just wanted to flee. I wanted to run. Chaplain Baldwin stood up after the fourth verse of that last song at the end of the evening and said, there's one more person that needs to come forward tonight. He said, "We're going to sing the first verse one more time. That's it, and you come forward." I wanted to slug him. I didn't know it was me. It wasn't me. I didn't want it to be me. But as soon as it was his wife playing the piano, I remember, as soon as his wife's hands hit the keyboard, my feet, David, took me up. And when I got to the front, I did not want to walk up and face Jim Irwin in front of this crowd of people. But a gentleman with a Bible as big as it could choke a horse, at least to me at that time, I thought. I found out later he is a senior, and I was a freshman at the Air Force Academy. Freshmen don't talk to seniors, by the way, at the Air Force Academy. This big Bible under his arm. I, of course, as a freshman, was in uniform. He was in civilian clothes. That's his privilege as an upperclassman. That's why I didn't recognize him as a superior. He looked at me with this big Bible under his arms and just smiled and said, "Would you like to talk about this?" I tried to say no. I tried to shake my head, and I just began to weep. So he pushed me toward the altar. Now I was in front of this big crowd. I had nowhere to go except right up to Jim Irwin. I walked up to Jim Irwin, the astronaut. His face was smiling. It looked like from ear to ear his face was going to split in two. And I thought, why am I here? And he looked at me with a smile and he said, "Do you want to receive the Lord Jesus Christ as your Savior?" And I tried to say no because I didn't even want to be there. And I eked out a week. I'm not even sure if I said no or yes. He just smiled and said, "It's okay." He pushed me to the altar. I went down on my knees and just began to weep. And that night, as I began to go back through the scripture and talk with that senior who had the big Bible, I tried to argue with him that I'd been a Christian my whole life. But he led me to the point of recognizing I had not yet fully embraced who God is. I was playing a game, and I knew that's for sure. I would go kind of with a hangover to sing in the choir as a freshman because I'd go Saturday night, drink the 3.2 beer in Colorado we could drink in those days, get a little tipsy on that, and get up early to go sing in the choir of obligation. But from that night, there was no more obligation. I sensed and I felt as though God came into my life, as though the very reality of Jesus Christ's sacrifice for me and his love for me became, for the first time in my life, genuine and real. And truly, my friends that knew me in those days as a young cadet, they saw a transformation and a change in my life. In fact, I'll jump ahead 3.5 years to when my wife, now of 29 years, was having a bridal shower hosted by my mother and my sister back in Michigan where we grew up, and I was in Colorado finishing my senior year at the academy before we were to marry. And my wife had spent a couple of years in Colorado getting to know each other as a young Christian man. And at this bridal shower, my mother and my sister hosted. All the women went home, and just those three ladies were at the kitchen table. My mother and sister began to tell these stories about this man my wife was about to marry, trying to warn her. He's got a problem with anger. He's got this problem. He's got that problem. And they told some stories of how I was pretty rough with my sister growing up. And my fiance, now wife of 29 years, didn't exactly defend me, but she said, "Well, no, he's changed. He's different now." And they said to her, "Okay, but be careful." And that night, my sister actually made that decision likewise, as my wife, fiance at the time, spoke with her about what it means to have a genuine faith, an encounter with God through Jesus Christ in a real way, not a plastic Jesus on your dashboard way, but a genuine way. And so it's been exciting because we did marry 2-3 weeks later, however long that was. And it's been 29 years, 5 kids, 2 careers, 3 careers. My wife struggles with Parkinson's now, unfortunately, but we trust in God and the difficulties we've been through with our son, with my wife and her health. We just lay them at the foot of the cross and say, "God, we don't like them. We would rather have 100% full health. And we're asking you to bring that health, and we're believing for that health to return to her. But ultimately, whether you bring that health or not, we trust in you because we know you are good and your character has been proven." And so my spiritual journey really, as you heard, kind of began as a young child with some interesting pinings that I remember to this day and didn't culminate when I was a freshman at the Air Force Academy, but really began in earnest. And in these years since, it's been, well, that was 1983, do the math. I've not been so faithful to him, but God has been faithful to me.
Well, that's quite a remarkable story. And it's one that I've heard similar from other people that are born again Christians. And I have a lot of respect for you and your testimony. I don't exactly share all of your views, but this program is not about debating the whys and wherefores. The only thing that I wanted to ask you, though, is how do you what is your position towards those of God's children who follow other faith traditions and believe that they found God through those particular vehicles? I'm just curious about that.
You know, so many people will very quickly go to a pat favorite scripture in the Gospels and the book of John when mm-hmm. Jesus was asked by his disciples something about, where are you going? Well, where I'm going, you cannot go. Well, where are you going? And he said, look, if you really knew me, you would know the way. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And they continue asking, but where are you going? How do we get there? Well, I'm not going to jump to that verse and say that no one can encounter God through seeking in genuineness.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is how we encounter God. Mm-hmm. I do believe that the scriptures, as we understand, are a representation of God's communication to us, and that guides our doctrine, our faith, our belief. But I think if someone is genuinely seeking God, I believe he will reveal himself, and they'll come to a realization. Yes, I believe and support that what the scripture says is what it means. But I'm telling you, one of my best friends today, who's the only Muslim who actually endorsed my book, is Muslim, a Bosnian friend. And he and I discuss all these issues of understanding, of doctrine, of theology, of how to encounter God and understand who God is, who Jesus Christ is. We're not in full agreement, but we love each other deeply. And I pray for him, and I know he prays for me. So, you know, I'm not going to say there are multiple ways, I would believe, toward knowing truly God in heaven. However, I believe that a true seeker will find him. And I believe that that's borne out in many people's experience and in the scriptures themselves.
Well, thank you for that. And I like the fact that you use the word love in reference to your friend. To me, that is the message that I understand that Jesus brought to this world. And I believe that that's what God has for all of his children. And so perhaps we can be in agreement on that point and move on to the supreme challenge that you had in your life with your son, Caleb.
I would say I can agree with that. In the Bible we read, God is love. Those who live in love, live in God, live in love. And so God is love, and we can agree on that common ground for this purpose, and I think we can help each other from that basis.
Well, that's great. You know, I will tell you this. My most listened to show was the very first show that I did, and it was with my cousin who's a born-again Christian, and we were able to find common ground, so I trust I've always been able to do that with each of my guests, and I appreciate what you had to say. Now, in your biography, it talks about multiple challenges. I'm going out on a limb and making an assumption that the challenge with Caleb's illness and death was perhaps one of the biggest crosses for you to bear.
I would say, without a doubt, we call the 3.5 years of our son's life the Caleb years, and some people wonder, what does that mean? Well, once again, in the Hebrew scriptures, there's a hero of old named Caleb. Joshua and Caleb were 2 of 12 spies sent by Moses to scout out this promised land, and it was a land flowing of milk and honey, and they were so excited, and yet they were also afraid because there were giants there that they didn't think they could conquer and go take that land. But the two faithful ones, Joshua and Caleb, did. And Caleb himself, as an old man years later, said to you, hey, I'm as strong as I was when I was a young man. Hey, boss, let me take this high mountain that has still some challenges. I'm ready to face that. And so Caleb years became synonymous of years of struggle, years of strife, years of difficulty, because the name Caleb means fighter, overcomer, bold one. And we believe we fought and we struggled and ultimately overcame during those years. And yes, the Caleb years, the years of my son's life, and actually, frankly, the 3.5 years after, sort of a 7-year period, were indeed among the most difficult of our lives.
Now, Caleb was born both with congenital heart defects and with HIV disease. Is that correct?
Not exactly. He was born with a number of life-threatening congenital anomalies, not the least of which was a seriously malformed heart. And as we began to treat and attempt to treat in a palliative fashion versus curative, the heart disease you don't cure, you just try to treat it to give some semblance of a effective life to the one born with such a serious heart defect. At any rate, he had 5 open heart surgeries during the course of his life, and during the 3rd open heart surgery, at the age of 16 months, he was infected with HIV due to contaminated blood transfusion, and just so it'll be
okay.
Right. When you have open heart surgery, especially as a child, there's such a great blood loss that normally it's not unusual to get one or multiple blood transfusions of whole blood right there at the end of or following the surgery. And of course, my son had received many transfusions. But unfortunately, this one, though it tested negative, was indeed positive for HIV.
What year was he born?
He was born in 1997.
And the blood supply was not safe at that point?
Well, no, I would not say that, David. What I would say is this. There's a test which is still used today, though there are newer generations of the test called NAT, N-A-A-T, Nucleic Acid Amplification Testing. And you can hear in that DNA, nucleic acid. So the DNA of... really, the antibodies in the blood of the host, the donor, the person who has the blood, that responds to the presence of, in this case, HIV or could be hepatitis or any particular virus that is being looked for. We look for the markers, the antigen, antibodies in the person's blood, and they amplify that, nucleic acid amplification testing, and then they can determine if you have a certain level of this certain antibody elevated in your blood, that's because you have the presence of this virus, HIV or what have you, hepatitis or what. So in the case of our son or the donor, he, and this nucleic acid amplification testing may not have been fully implemented yet in 1998. This was July 1998 when the blood was drawn and then transfused. But the military started with it first, incidentally, and then it had been implemented pretty well universally by then, but it was still relatively new. So we have all the documents from the blood center, and we are reasonably confident that the NAT testing was followed procedurally, and as far as we can tell by observing the documents, was tested properly. But what likely occurred was what we call a window infection, meaning the virus needs a certain period of time to in the body of the host to have the immune system respond and the antibodies to elevate to a certain point, virus to be detectable. And all that time frame to grow, though it varies, we call it a window. So to effectively test a unit of blood that's drawn from a donor who got infected in this window, and at that time they thought it was 3 to 6 weeks. Today they say it's between 6 and 11 days. Well, frankly, it doesn't really matter if it's 6 days, 11 days, 3 weeks, 6 weeks. If you're prone to HIV at-risk behavior within that window of time, you still pose a threat. And it's not part of our conversation today, but it's something that's important for us to understand. We don't know what the behavior of the donor was, although we do know that he knew of his at-risk behavior. Whatever that behavior was, he did not disclose it during the little mini medical history given to the blood center. And we don't know if he lied about his behavior or if it's behavior that's not addressed. My contention actually is behavior not addressed. And I really got involved in blood, so we don't maybe want to get off track and talk about blood, but I was a blood collection officer at Andrews Air Force Base after my son died, and I did a lot with blood. I lobbied Congress to improve blood safety laws, but that's not our topic for tonight, so I'll stop talking about blood with that.
Well, that's okay, but I think that it is, there's an important message there, and HIV is a serious illness virus for somebody to contract. And so thank you for educating me a little bit about the blood situation. And I had no idea what the window was involved there. Let's talk about the challenges that your son's illness has represented to you and how you managed to hang on to your faith and what your faith did to get you through those 3.5 years in the aftermath.
If any of your readers, I'm sorry, your listeners read my book, they'll notice that the opening, I'm not sure if it's 3, 4, 5, or 6 chapters, but the opening number of chapters cover only a couple of days, and there's a lot of activity. And much of the activity interspersed with what was happening, I share what I was feeling, what I was thinking. And I'm here to tell you, David, much of what I felt and thought at that time was overwhelming numbness. And if you've ever heard the expression drinking from a fire hose, where you have so much information, new information, cataclysmic information coming at you, and uncertainty and question marks, it's just, it's overwhelming. And I found myself just slipping out of consciousness in a sense and saying, help, I can't keep myself stable here, but I'm in charge, meaning these doctors, they think my child is hopeless. They think he's going to die. And I was struggling with this dilemma between, do I trust the medical people who are all looking hopeless because they know enough to know that this is a hopeless child with his many, many serious congenital anomalies, none of which were diagnosed interutero, so they were all a big surprise after he was born, and he was a full 5 days overdue. So here I was struggling with, in my own little mental torture chamber all alone, what do I do? And there's a funny story where when I was a cadet at the Air Force Academy, screaming, shouting, doing push-ups, and the whole experience there, I looked up at this rock on the side of a mountain, the funny outcropping that hung there for years and years, and I sort of surreptitiously named it Inspiration Point. I said, okay, as long as that little rock remains in the top of that peak, I'm going to stay here at the Academy. I'm going to make it through and not get, wash out because it's a tough program, so to speak. Well, and I made it. And so that inspiration, suddenly, when the child was born and I was just struggling with, what do? I sort of reached back to that inspiration point and said, okay, God, if you're there, if you're with me, I need some help here. I'm about to lose my mind. I don't know what to do. The doctors are acting hopeless. Everyone is acting hopeless, but this child needs to live. We named the child when he was only 6 months in his mother's womb. We named him Caleb. It's written in my journal, and it's dated from 6 months before or 7 months before he was born. We felt like God gave us the name Fighter, Caleb. And so that night, the day of his birth, and then for the next much of the 3.5 years, I was honest. I said, God, I'm struggling here. I don't like what's happening. I wish it weren't, but I have to take action. I need to be in charge here. I need to direct the doctors. I need to study. So I began to read. I began to have, in those days, there was no internet to go and surf Mr. Google, but my wife is a nurse. Her mother's a nurse. They started clipping articles from various medical journals. They would send me things, fax me things. I began to read, and people began to talk to me throughout my son's care as though I were a doctor. And I was asked so many times, oh, so you're a provider. That means you're a doctor. And I would say, yes, I just have one patient, my son, because I really reached a point where I knew I could talk to you about heart disease. My son's type of heart disease. I could talk to you about tracheoesophageal atresia and tracheoesophageal fistula and anal rectal malformations, and my son had an imperfor anus. I could talk about all of those things because I studied, I learned, I applied myself. I knew I had to take charge. I knew I had to speak for my son. He couldn't speak for himself. And likewise, my faith, I said, God, I need some help here. And I had some real times of struggles, but ultimately I sensed God's presence and his power. I will tell you one quick aside. During the years after my son died, in the first 3.5 years, at one point my wife was watching her husband, and she confided in a friend that she only told me years later recently. She wondered if her husband was going to turn from his faith because she began to observe his passion for God and for, you know, the gospel and for the evangelistic work he had done for years that I had done were sort of becoming not so important. And she didn't confide in her husband and ultimately in me, but ultimately God saw me through that. And I believe part of how I got through that was I was honest. I admitted my anger with God because he's big enough to take it. And I think true faith says, I'm willing to be honest and say, God, I don't agree with what you let happen here. I'm angry. I don't think this should have happened. This innocent child shouldn't have been afflicted, shouldn't have died. We can look around the world, look at the people who died in the tsunami, look at the recent shootings in South Carolina in the church there, 9 people innocent were killed. The Bible says when one of us grieves, weeps, we all weep, and we should weep. It also says when one rejoices, we all rejoice, and we should. But ultimately, you need to be honest. I was honest. Sometimes it meant that I showed I was nearly about to lose my mind. But we were grounded. I was grounded in the goodness of God and who he is, and I clung to the fact. There's a story in the Old Testament where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these are Hebrew men, those were names given them by a foreign pagan god, who they weren't obeying him, and he was going to throw them into this furnace that he heated up 7 times hotter than normal, according to the story, and they said, O king. And the king said, look, fellas, I don't want to do this. Bow down and worship this idol I set up, some big 40-foot idol or something like that. And they said, no, king, we won't do it. Our God is able to save us, but even if he doesn't save us, he is still our God. I'm glad that's written, because I had to cling to that concept. God, I want you to heal my son. I'm believing you will, and I need you to. He needs you too. But even if you don't, you're still my God. And if that can be said in frankness and honesty and tears and sorrow and angst and agony, then I believe you have real faith, and you will get through these difficult times. And everyone goes through difficult times. It doesn't matter how bad it is. We don't compare one person's difficulty to another. We just say, what are you going to do? Are you going to let your difficulty define you? Or are you going to be defined by your faith and in whom you believe? I chose to be defined by my faith and in whom I believe, even in agonizing despair.
Well, that's remarkable. And David has written a book called The Caleb Years, subtitled When God Doesn't Make Sense. And I was thinking when you were talking initially about how numb you felt, that title really resonated, because it's almost as if there was no sense going on for you, or you couldn't make sense out of the situation that was going on. But I liked that you found a way to get honest with God, to give him what was in your heart and turn it over. And so many people have been through not necessarily the same situation, but similarly emotionally charged situations where they have been brought to their knees. And it's at times like that that people really can find out where their strength comes from. And so thank you for your testimony on that. What was the aftermath like for you?
real quick, like I'll say something about before the child died. When you say aftermath, I think of you're thinking of after his death. Is that correct?
Correct. Or, yeah.
Okay. One thought before the child died, but I'm telling you, David, this was carried into the into the period after his death. I was our worship leader in addition to being an evangelist and different things in our church in Okinawa, and a woman who was there, Sandy, was the keyboard. We had a very good and close relationship as I would bring together songs to come together and worship and sing, and we stayed in close contact. She was a very good prayer warrior, as we say, for us with our son. She sent me a message, I think it was via email one night, and said, David, you're not being honest enough. You're not being honest with God. You sound too positive, too upbeat. And I read that message from her, and I thought, Sandy, why are you saying this to me? Come on now, we're supposed to be positive and upbeat because we're rising above our difficulties. But as I thought those words sort of rebuked me with, okay, knucklehead, are you going to be honest and get through this, or are you going to just pretend and not get through this? And I said, no, I'm not going to pretend. I don't want to play a game. And so that was the first time I encountered being honest and expressing anger with God. And that message she sent me that night really helped me. Well, moving into the period after the child died, there's one story that's so vivid to me. It was about 18 months, I think, after Caleb's death. I was a pilot at the Presidential Airlift Wing at Andrews Air Force Base, flying Gulfstreams, their corporate airplanes, flying the cabinet members and such around the world. I just finished a 21-day trip flying the Honorable Colin Powell when he was the Secretary of State around the world. And at the end of this three-week trip, we were flying a G5, a Gulfstream 5, and at that time, probably the top corporate business jet. And I remember the normal procedure was we taxied into base operations at Andrews Air Force Base right in Washington, D.C. The party, as we say, would leave the plane. We had the engine shut down. And after the party left, a little motorcade, the pilot in command who landed that leg, that last arrival, would walk outside, walk around the airplane, start it up and taxi it, move it over to a permanent parking place, you know, for overnight before you go home. When I was standing outside the plane and watched the motorcade depart, I rendered the salute as normal. I turned to my right, back toward the plane, looked up at the window in the cockpit, and I woke up, meaning I had this strong sensation that that airplane had spent a lot of hours on autopilot at altitude during this long trip we were just on, and it occurred to me, David, that I was on autopilot just like the plane. And when I woke up, it was the first time in 18 months I felt lucid. My mind was back in my body, in my head. It's very difficult to describe, except the sensation was I woke up. I had been on autopilot for 18 months just like that plane. And I was doing my duty. I was doing my job, but as I wrote in my book, at one point, ice cream no longer had taste or flavor, and the blue sky wasn't blue, it was gray. Everything was gray and dark and dreary and numb. And I don't know how I woke up. I guess maybe after 18 months, most people wake up. But I actually believe that part of getting my mind back to me was being honest during those difficult, dismal years of despair that I was despairing. And, you know, it's like when you work out really hard, exercise really hard, and your muscles are sore, but you have a euphoric feeling. And I suppose the scientists, the doctors will tell us about the various chemicals or adrenaline that's coursing through our veins that gives us that little feeling. And it was like that. I felt drained, and yet I felt renewed and revived. And I'm thankful that sensation came to me. It doesn't always come when you think back and remember, but that was the experience, and I thank God for it, actually, for that recovery time.
You had the opportunity to experience the depth of human emotion and to embrace the fact that you are human, just as Jesus was, and certainly even he knew anger at points in his life, righteous anger. And it sounds like you knew righteous anger too. I was thinking about the years, the 18 months that you were on autopilot, and thinking that that was a blessing in disguise, and that God was giving you an opportunity to go through some of the things that you needed to do on a daily basis, even as numb as you were feeling. Perhaps the blessing was that you would not have been able to cope if you had gone into the pit of despair and anger and all of that at an earlier point in time. I truly believe everything happens for a reason. What do you think about that?
You know, on the one hand, I would say yes. On the other hand, I see that, you know, according to the construct of my faith of Genesis, of God's creation, and what we call often in Christendom, quote, the fall, unquote, you know, when sin entered in, so to speak, when man disobeyed God and corruption came to the creation that wasn't in its perfection, I actually think that God allows things to happen that he probably would rather not happen. We certainly would rather not happen, but he allows them. Do I understand and know why he allows them? No, if I'm honest. Some of us pretend we know. I don't know. I can't claim to know. Well, does a reason happen for a purpose? I'm not sure if it does. However, I can insist that a purpose that's positive and good comes out of it. When I go through bankruptcy, I can decide to really learn some lessons I should have learned perhaps that got me into bankruptcy. When my wife is struggling with her latest struggle with Parkinson's, diagnosed at the tender young age of 46, I can say, I don't care what the reason this happened is, I want it to stop. And then I can sit down and pout and go nowhere. Or I can say, God, I don't understand, and I don't want this to be this way, but you know what? I would rather have a wife with Parkinson's disease and truly live a productive, helpful, serving life with some limitations that we may not have had, than get all wrapped around ourselves. There's a book by Philip Yancey, and Philip Yancey has endorsed my book. He's a pretty big Christian author. He writes about who's the famous Michael J. Fox, about Michael J. Fox and his struggles with Parkinson's. And Michael J. Fox makes a statement that is written about in Philip Yancey's book. The latest one is called The Question That Never Goes Away. Why? He said, if you walked in and offered me, I don't know if he says $10,000, $10 million, whatever, some number, and to take away Parkinson's, and I go back to the life I had before, I wouldn't take the money. I wouldn't go back to my life I had before, because I was basically self-focused, career-focused, and the Parkinson's has changed me to be in a better man and a better person. When we read that, when my wife read that, she was excited. Not that she needs that, and that's the thing I said. I said, God, my wife doesn't need that. She's already a wonderful woman. But the point is, does everything happen for a reason? Well, if you choose to respond by faith and not be controlled and defined by the things that happen that are undesirable, yes, the reason is that God would be glorified. It doesn't feel that way, but I believe that is the way. Hey, may I make one comment? Yeah.
Go ahead.
About the grieving element and something you said we talked about with that waking up, so to speak. I was in Israel. I was in Tel Aviv, and in this top of a hotel sometimes they give little treats, and we were up there because they wouldn't – our organization, our chain of command, didn't allow us to leave the hotel when we were on a trip taking some congressmen to Israel during the Intifada times. And I was talking to this Israeli lady in that snack bar, and I was practicing my Hebrew alphabet. I had her help me a little bit because I'd forgotten some things. And somehow my son came up and had recently died, and she told me, you know, in Israel, she said, and you may have read this somewhere, and I had actually read this somewhere, that they would hire wailers, like pay them, and I don't know how long, 2 weeks or whatever period, that would just wail and cry to cover the family of a deceased person. So you can cry all you want and just cry it all out. I wrote in my journal that night after hearing that from her and said, I wish we had that, because in our culture, we try to pretend that, come on, your son died a month ago. You should be over it by now. Well, you don't get over it. And if you don't cry your eyes out in the early days, I think you carry around the little seeds of a cancer that may blossom and bloom later in life, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And I just think that it goes back to anything that may cause grieving in life, loss of a job, loss of a relationship, whatever it may be, we need to grieve. And I think that grieving and that numbness that we talked about is a blessing and a protective measure from God. Anyhow, I just thought I'd interject that story as we went along, because I think it's important and it's helpful. And I would say it helped me.
I do too. I think it's very naive of a person to suggest that you just put it behind you. Obviously, those are the choices they've made in their life, and God only knows what the consequences for them are. But I like what you said about choosing a positive direction for your life and a positive outcome in spite of whatever the challenge is. And I think that that's what separates the so-called winners from the losers. I would like to talk a little bit about intentionality and hard work that you refer to in the biography that you sent me. But first of all, would you tell the listeners where they can get a copy of your book?
Yes, sir, you bet. The book is available through probably any traditional retailer that your listeners are familiar with, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, ChristianBook.com, and there are so many out there. If they just Google or search on the internet for the Caleb years, they'll get many, many different hits. Or if they go to my website, which is www.thecalebyears.com, thecalebyears, thecalebyears.com, there's a place there that takes them where it says available at fine retailers. They can even order it direct from me through my website. And most of the retailers will give them a chapter or two. Website gives them a preview as well.
And if anybody ever wanted to contact you that might have heard this show, is there a way for them to do that through your website?
Yes, sir. There's a link that says contact, and if they want to reach me for any reason, to just make a comment or what have you, absolutely. We also have a button there that says to schedule a request an author event, meaning if they want me to address a group or something like that, I'm happy to do that. And then, of course, there's another little link where they can give their own little review or response to the book that would be posted on my website. All that's available through my website, you bet.
That sounds great. All right, well, let's move on. I would like to talk a little bit about your definition of success and how you found that. And there certainly are so many things that I would have liked to have asked you about your experience with Caleb. And if there are other people that are going through difficulties similar to yours, I would encourage them to reach out to David through his website. Before we move on, maybe I should just ask you briefly, because time is running short, is there any particular advice that you would offer to parents who are going through a similarly traumatic situation as to how to weather the trials and tribulations?
Number one, I always encourage folks that you need to take charge. You need to recognize the medical community in this country is fantastic. Great infrastructure, great doctors, great education, great experiences, but no one has the responsibility for the child but you. And you need to educate yourself about whatever malady, that may not be a child, it could be a parent or yourself, what have you. So you need to educate yourself so you can guide and direct the care and make the decisions, because the doctors are going to advise you, like a contractor would advise you who's remodeling your house. But they look to you to make the decisions. And when it comes to the emotional side, you need to be honest. You probably don't need to be honest in front of the doctor, but go be honest when you're home or what have you to get those feelings out, to deal with them, and in a business fashion, so to speak, take care of your child, take care of your family member, take care of yourself, and make the right decisions. And sometimes the medical community can be overworked, and they need your help. So it's important, I think, to recognize that. And there are so many out there that are available to help you. Support groups of any type. We were involved in a number of support groups for children, parents of children with heart disease, parents of children with EATEF, esophageal atresia, tracheoesophageal fistula, any number of things. Reach out to others. We contributed a lot to these organizations and received a lot from them. So get help from others.
I think that's great advice. It's a great way to surrender yourself to something that's greater than yourself, and not only receive practical advice from people who've been there and gone through it, but who may be expressions of God's wisdom coming through other human beings.
Absolutely.
And, so that's just a comment I wanted to make about that. We have a little less than 10 minutes left. I'd like to spend some time talking to you about intentionality and what you mean by that, and what has contributed to you finding the pathway to success.
We, at the end of each year and the beginning of the next year, we have a prayerful, contemplative time in my household. I have even been known to take a big whiteboard and I have all my children in front of it, and we write down an assessment of the previous year. It can be emotional, it can be spiritual, it can be personal, it can be relational, it can be academic for the kids in school, business for the parents in business as an entrepreneur. We assess it honestly, and then we set and establish goals for the next year. And we do this all bathed in prayer, asking God to guide us, to lead us, and to help us for His glory. And if we have His glory at the first objective, then I believe we will be successful. And if our purpose is to be in business, for example, to help others, and for me it is, then I believe we will be successful. Does that mean we're going to make a lot of money? I don't know that I would yet say that. Maybe if we talk in a couple of years, I'll have a different answer. Because in 10 years in business, we haven't made a whole lot of money, and yet we've been able to help a lot of people. We have a payroll of more than 30 people. It's not much compared to big Fortune 500 companies, but our people know we care about them. And the folks that work with us on our team, they know that we care deeply about them. My wife recognizes birthdays with treats and celebrations. We do as much as we can to help folks recognize that we care. And in this way, it goes to whether it's a customer or an employee, an associate, a partner, or a vendor, someone that works with us in that way. We want to make things better for others and help each other and recognize that sometimes with an unusual situation, that's one of the keys with being successful in a retail business, by the way, I've found, is that 90% of the, or maybe 95% of your customer encounter situations, whatever it may be, if you're selling a product, selling a service, is normal, and I use the word vanilla, easy. However, that remaining 5%, maybe it's 10%, whatever that remaining small number is, there's special attention needed for whatever reason. A customer with a special situation. In our case, dry clean laundry, one thing we do, a garment with a special situation. Whatever a special thing is that causes an unusual need, go the extra mile when that unusual need comes up in whatever service or product or what you sell or provide. And people will know then that you truly do care about them, and you'll be successful. Sometimes people turn to me and say, hey, boss, don't we need to charge more if we're giving all this extra time and attention to this one customer for this one situation? And I'll look at them and I'll say, well, perhaps, but actually, perhaps not. Because 95 out of 100, we don't need to, and this 5 out of 100, give the extra attention. It might be a case where someone's on their way to a funeral, someone's on their way to this or that when it comes to dry clean laundry, and they need fast service. Well, give them the fast service and don't charge them an additional fee because 95 out of 100 people don't need that, so to speak. I just think that that type of intentionality helps everyone know you're serious about caring for others.
Well, that's how you establish goodwill with your customers. And
you bet.
I like what you were saying about putting behind you selfish desires and doing things to help others. I've heard it said, and I believe it's true, that it's no good unless you pass it on. And we're all in this life to not only be leading abundant lives, but the way that we can do that the most genuinely is by being of service to each other.
We're
all got children, we're all sisters and brothers, and unfortunately there are a number of people in this world who don't realize that and don't lead very happy lives. Well, you know, it's been a wonderful hour. Is there anything else that you would like to say about your book or that you would like to say about your personal journey with God?
You know, yes, David, there are two last things that come to mind that I think are important. One is this. I had an interview some months ago where the gentleman had read the book and he said, David, I'm here to tell you, I'm here to tell my listeners, if they just got the book and just read the epilogue by Miss Kathleen, my wife, it's worth the price of the book. And I
really?
Said, David, his name was David also. And I said, David, I couldn't agree more. And then I told more about the story of the backstory of her writing the epilogue with her left hand with one finger on an iPad at 3:30, 4:30 in the morning over a course of 4 months when she was initially, before she was diagnosed with Parkinson's, and the right side of her body was basically not paralyzed, but unusable. And she's right-handed, but she couldn't write, she couldn't type. So with her left hand, one finger, dink, dink, dink on an iPad, she dinked out this epilogue. And it's a precious, precious word from my wife and her summation of the Caleb years. And very simply, she addresses three key things. And the one that I'll mention, I address too in my book itself, is the issue of forgiveness, and especially with the shootings in Charleston that we've all been so aware of over the recent days, as we've prayed for these folks and we've seen such courageous verbal public expressions of forgiveness by victims' family members from the beginning. I applaud these folks for doing that. It's one thing we learned, and I even have a statement in my book that says this, referring to the donor who gave his HIV positive blood that infected my son. I said this, his action was inexcusable, but it was forgivable. What that means is this. I know that I have done things that are wrong and bad and I shouldn't have done. I know that I don't deserve the blessings and goodness of God's favor that I enjoy, but I'm thankful for them. And I know that this gentleman, at the time, a 37-year-old male donor in the Detroit area who gave at a work center, he knew he had at-risk behavior. He shouldn't have given his blood. He should have known better. In fact, it was thought that he was going from center to donate his blood to be tested to see if he was infected instead of going to an AIDS clinic or a doctor. And it's been documented. I heard on an NPR program some years ago that it's been well known that that's been done, which is obviously not a good thing. If you're at risk of any infection, don't go give blood, please. But if you're safe, give blood. So at any rate, the forgiveness issue, David, is so important because we're not saying what the person did that offended us is okay, but we're saying it's not my responsibility to hold them accountable. It's the responsibility of the government or of God or what have you, but it's not mine. It's mine to forgive so that I am free from any bitterness and that I can't be controlled by the action of that person, therefore, I'm freed from it. And that's a key topic toward the end of our book and that my wife touched on too on her epilogue, and we just think it's so important to understand you need to exercise the courage to forgive someone who's wronged you. Doesn't mean you're saying what they did is okay, and it's liberating to understand that.
Well, that's beautiful, and as far as I'm concerned, there can be no unconditional love unless there is forgiveness.
Indeed.
And as you say, it's a gift you give to yourself. You free yourself from bitterness, anger, and resentments. And that's another way you can let go. So thank you very much for joining me tonight, David.
Yes, sir. It was a pleasure. I've enjoyed it very much.
Likewise. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings, a human experience, who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.